renegade economist is saying, yeah.
Economics for activists. Economics is being made. Economics is being made. These are the tools activists need. How can we calculate it? What motivates people? Why do people spend money? Understand the basics to economics.
This week we're talking Keynesian economics. Keynesian economics with Polly Cleveland. Polly Cleveland from Columbia University.
Go into a lot of deficit spending like we're doing now, this is dandy for the rich folks because we're giving them lots of nice, safe treasury bonds to hang on to. And if they're hanging on to treasury bonds, then they are not investing money back into the economy. The conservatives always accuse the liberals of being tax and spend, but the conservatives are borrow and spend. And the borrowers and the recipients of the spending tend to be the same folks at the top of the heap. The guys up at the top are getting loads and loads of economic rent at the expense of the taxpayers.
And there we have Polly Cleveland coming up soon on the show. Welcome to The Renegade Economist with Carl Fitzgerald. And wow, hasn't the political atmosphere changed out there? Would you have thought you'd have heard of a class action on Australia's banks? And one of those banks, the NAB, having paid people back, or started the process anyway before the court case has even gone to air. Wow. What about Obama speaking out publicly against Halliburton, BP and Transocean over their disastrous Senate inquiry presentations last week? On top of that, over in Iceland, the people are fuming. Maybe that's why their volcano is billowing. Well, bankers over there are being rounded up. They're being arrested in some cases, and the heat is building globally on white-collar criminals who have seen a loophole, a gap, the ability to massage the media to get away with millions. And millions. Why did the GFC occur? People spent too much on land, and that was allowed to happen because the tax game has been changed. Taxes have been switched off the wealthy, the major property owners, and pushed back onto working class people. We talked last week about the public only capturing $40 billion out of the $325 billion that naturally grows each year from our land-based society. We live on land. We must share the natural value from it. It's always going to get more scarce. So as those prices go up, why not give that to the government rather than impinge 125 taxes upon us all? It's a killer, and it's strangling our very freedoms. It's strangling our abilities to do what we really want to do. And that's what we talk about here at Earth Sharing Australia, is unfurling the powers of monopoly upon our natural opportunities. What we should be able to do with our own two hands. The landlords, the bankers, and the monopolists have tied this up. They've privatized the planet. And we're given the only solution is to tax more consumption. Stop the consumers. Yes, we agree with that. But taxing consumption is a regressive way to run society. And it's heating up on the resource rents debate. You know, we're really still pinching ourselves. For 100 odd years, our movement's been underway. We've been trying to push the value of the earth, the value of the land. And there's Ken Henry. He's come out in the report and he's talking about economic rent, which is the real golden goose Joe Hockey should be talking about. Economic rent is mentioned in things as diverse as gambling and pokie machines, and also taxi licenses, and of course, front and center with the resource rents tax, and BHP's warning about the tax to threaten their dividends to their 540,000 shareholders. Well, why? What a pity the government didn't install a citizens' dividend and perhaps put a 50% resource rent on the devils. God, did they create the earth? And put 10% of that in as a citizens' dividend. So any of the revenue taken from the miners could be given directly back to the people. That would certainly ostracise the mining elite, the red carpet elite, from talking as if this is a real threat to the Australian people, because, of course, we would all have an interest in sharing the bounty of the earth. And it was good to see Ken Henry today talking up the fact that Indigenous people should certainly get a share of these resource rents. And, wow, what a tragedy it is to hear that. What a tragedy it is to hear that Indigenous people only get 1/8 of 1% of all royalties. Many of that is dodged, as we well know. But the bigger argument with the resource rents is that Judith Sloan today is talking up all sorts of issues. Actually, it was yesterday in the Sydney Morning Herald, the Melbourne University professor and former Santos director. Luckily, she declared that, but gee, she ranted on in the press about what sort of a mongrel tax this is, and was ridiculing Australia's productivity performance as having been poor in the last decade and even poorer in the last year. And she goes on to say, with the resource super profit tax, this drag on productivity from the mining sector will be even greater, as the anticipated marginal projects, low quality ore bodies for instance, come on stream. And she does mention somewhere else that productivity growth underpins higher living standards. Fair enough, Judith, but listen. Productivity underpins the living standards for the mainstream, but if you're a mining magnate, you're not interested in productivity so forth. You're interested in the price of iron ore. And when that goes up by some 40 to 50% as it has last year, you are rubbing your hands together, as you've just almost, you've got a huge windfall gain there. And so rather than productivity being the key issue with resource rents, it is profits, it is price. And when scarcity delivers these windfall gains to the elite, we need to consider sharing it. And these windfall gains occur when natural resources, prime locations, licensed monopolies all become more and more valuable. So that is the source of the argument. Please write letters into the local papers. We've got to show that the people understand these resources are everybody's. They are not just those who are lucky enough to have a license to dig up this beautiful planet. And remember that Ecuador charges an 83% resource rent on their gas, and Norway an 80% on their oil. So this isn't unheard of. And in Norway, as we've talked about before, many companies queue up trying to get access to those resources. All right.
Contemporary music and personality and conversation.
Sliding between formats here, and yeah, we've got to keep the pressure on. And over the weekend, the auction clearance rates dropped again. There was, I think, about a 10% lower stock than the week before, and clearance rates are down in the 70%, according to the REIV. According to Australian Property Monitors, they're a lot lower than that. Yeah, maybe down towards 55%. So things are heating up. They're slowing down, actually, in the property market. Do not buy property. We're just about to step into an interview with Polly Cleveland discussing Keynesian economics, which is, of course, government borrowing, pumping up the economy, stepping in place for the private sector. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Today, we're lucky to have Polly Cleveland, who's the Adjunct Professor of Environmental Economics at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. Polly, welcome to the Renegade Economists.
Well, thank you so much, and give my love to Down Under. I lived in Sydney as a child.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Wow. Well, we're in this Western alliance. We're battling away in Afghanistan and Iraq, and things aren't going so well.
The engagement in Afghanistan is only a small part of it. There's just a tremendous amount of military spending on producing useless equipment.
A lot of talk has gone on for many years about the use of defense spending as a form of Keynesian pump priming, and a lot of defense contractors set up their large production houses in marginal electorate seats.
As far as I know, but military spending is the least, creates the least jobs per capita invested. I mean, it doesn't create, you're just paying people to waste stuff, and you can get a lot more jobs and economic activity if you gave a little bit of money to a street vendor, you know, selling hot dogs, because a guy like that is very productive. He takes home his little capital every day and reinvests it in more hot dogs. Instead, we're just wasting capital all over the place, not just in the military, but in building roads and bridges to nowhere.
Why exactly is military-based spending so wasteful?
Because it doesn't produce any goods at the other end. In a, you know, in a little economic cycle that we learn in introductory economics, people go to work, capitalists supply capital, and natural resource owners supply land, and you put them all together and you get goods, and the suppliers get paid, and the people get to eat the goods or you know, the clothes or other items. But if you are just paying people to produce something useless that they can't consume, it's inflationary and wasteful and destructive to the economy. It's dumping your wealth down a bottomless hole.
There's also a few examples of rather large CEO wages in the military and the occasional golden toilet seat being produced.
That's sort of the tip of the iceberg. You know, what are we spending this money for? We're spending this money to control territory overseas. I think we have something over 140, 150 bases all around the world because we're controlling territory overseas for the benefit primarily of our international corporations, you know, providing them with security so that they can go on bringing home the oil and the other goods that they bring home. And this doesn't do any good for the economy. It's just a waste of money. And it distributes income to the top of the heap, too. I mean, the guys up at the top are getting loads and loads of economic rent at the expense of the taxpayers.
Now, the American recession has been underway for close to 2 years now, and this October there's the next round of adjustable rate mortgages to hit the wall, to hit their exploding interest rate regime, where interest rates will jump from 3% to 11%. Not so much has been done for them, but the military budget continues to rage ahead. The neocons, what have they been up to, the conservatives, trying to deflect blame?
Well, the neocons are interested in cutting social spending. They're very much afraid that in a depression like this, people are going to want to raise taxes to keep the school teachers in the schools and the policemen on the streets. So they are going on and on about how terrible all this deficit spending is for the economy, and therefore we have to cut social spending, you know, tighten our belts, just what we're trying to do to Greece. Well, the problem with that is they are ignoring another possibility, which is that you can raise taxes on the rich and not just obviously the bankers who took home huge bonuses, but all the rich property owners up and down the East and West Coast, there are a number of very wealthy people who are now paying far lower taxes than they did 30 or 40 years ago. So what the deficit hawks would like to do is say, oh, my God, great big depression, recession, have to cut Social Security, have to cut Medicare, have to cut schools. You know, don't waste money on school lunches. Don't waste money on education and training. We can't afford it. All this public spending is ruining the economy. And they're trying to keep us from realizing that part of our problem is that over the years we have dramatically cut taxes on the richer end of society and, of course, dramatically increased the subsidies and the benefits also going to the richer end.
Well, the economic argument by the neocons has been if we reduce the taxes off the wealthy, they will have more income to invest back in our economy so that there are more jobs and from that wages will go up. What has been the resultant change in the economy?
Well, this is a favorite argument, which even some liberals believe. The problem is, and George definitely saw this one, that, you know, rich people, large corporations, you know, sure, they save and invest a lot, but they save and invest very, very unproductively. If you got lots of money and lots of wealth, you're going to use it sloppily and wastefully, or just sit on a lot of valuable land and not use it. I mean, I remember when I lived in San Francisco, there's a lot of land belonging to the railroads or in Southern California, and they got this land as land grants, you know, 100 years ago. Henry George was complaining about it, and they don't use it. They don't have to. So, no, the rich, the job creators in the economy are the small business, because they have very little capital and resources, and so they have to use them very intensively. So they're the ones who provide the jobs. And if you give money to the rich, they're not going to provide jobs, because they're going to invest in racehorse stables or things like that that don't provide a lot of jobs, and the capital is cut off from the poorer people. And when you go into a lot of deficit spending like we're doing now, this is dandy for the rich folks, because we're giving them lots of nice, safe treasury bonds to hang on to. And if they're hanging on to treasury bonds, then they are not investing money back into the economy. The conservatives always accuse the liberals of being tax and spend, but the conservatives are borrow and spend. And the borrowers and the recipients of the spending tend to be the same folks at the top of the heap.
The car is on fire, and there's no driver at the wheel. And the sewers are all muddied with 1,000 lonely suicides. And a dark wind blows. The government is corrupt, and we're on so many drugs with the radio on and the curtains drawn. We're trapped in the belly of this horrible machine, and the machine is bleeding to death. The sun has fallen down, and the billboards are all leering. And the flags were all dead at the top of their poles. It went like this. The buildings toppled in on themselves. Mothers clutching babies picked through the rubble and pulled out their hair. On fire, all twisted metal stretching upwards, everything washed in a thin orange haze. I I said, kiss me, you're beautiful. These are truly the last days.
Godspeed, you Black Emperor. Now we're back speaking to Polly Cleveland from Columbia Uni.
Fell into it, like a daydream or a fever.
Can you explain to us your criticism of using government bonds as a financing mechanism?
Well, if you're talking about the banking system, I mean, we need the banking system, and we especially need the credit system. Small business is totally dependent on revolving credit. And that's been drying up, because what's happening at the moment is the Federal Reserve Bank is essentially lending money at zero interest rate to the six biggest banks. And instead of lending it out, they're just sitting on it. And the reason they're sitting on it is that their balance sheets are in very bad shape, because they've got a lot of bad assets on it. And if they were to write down those bad assets to market, they would be insolvent or bankrupt. And that's why, of course, they don't want to lower mortgages on houses, even when the mortgages are more than the house, because they don't want people to recognize that they are essentially bankrupt. So what's happening is the Fed is giving these big guys zero interest loans, and they are lending it mostly again to big guys. And they are rebuilding their balance sheets by making profits where they don't have to pay for the money.
What do you think of Obama's banking reforms? And should the big eight banks be given this free credit that they can use to expand to nine times that initial amount under fractional reserve deposit banking?
I don't have a problem with the concept of fractional reserves. It makes reasonable sense, though, when they don't go crazy. But you had Lehman had, its liabilities were 30 times its equity. That was wildly out of line. Statistically, fractional reserve makes perfectly good sense if the banks are behaving cautiously otherwise. You know, and once in a while there will be a financial crisis. The great English observer of banking, Walter Badgett, recommendation is when there is a crisis, he says, the central bank should lend freely but at a penalty, just to keep the economy going and keep people believing, you know, their loans will be paid and they can get financing. But it's the at a penalty part that got forgotten. What I think should have happened, and Simon Johnson has come out with a new book called 13 Bankers, is what should have happened is that the government should have taken over the big banks, operated them for a little while, and then chopped them up and sold off the good pieces. But, of course, politically they couldn't do that, because that would have meant not only wiping out the shareholders, but forcing a big loss on the bondholders of the bank. That is, in the popular term, giving them a haircut. And politically, the banks were too powerful to allow the government to take them over, bust them up, and give them a haircut. Now, that's what the Swedes did. The Swedes had a banking crisis, 89, 90, somewhere in there. And the government did, in fact, take over the banks, operated them for about 4 years, and cleaned them up and turned them loose again. I think they busted up some of them in the process. But that's what should have happened. Instead, you know, these banks, they own us. They absolutely own us. But as these scandals break about Goldman Sachs, maybe the politicians will start listening to an angry public, and maybe they will do something.
And one of the biggest reasons that limits the government's ability to impinge any serious reforms on the banking elite or the privileged in the property sector is that so few actually understand the way economics and tax work hand in hand. And one example here is how badly America's own tax system has slipped, in that now some two-thirds of American families pay more payroll tax than income tax, according to one of your recent blog posts on Economiki.
The U.S. tax system has become increasingly regressive, because the payroll tax is a tax on salaries, on wages and salaries, up to a limit, something over $100,000 now, but obviously it doesn't take a nick out of the guys who are making millions every year. And it has reached a level that it is a serious killer of jobs at the small business level. I mean, there's a basic take of 17%, but then when you add in all of the other items, unemployment insurance and that kind of thing, it's a very serious discouragement to small business hiring and to poorer people working, because they live so close to the margin that a tax like that is just chases them out of the workforce, or at least it chases them out of the official workforce and into the so-called informal economy where everybody gets paid cash. So at this point, the payroll tax is actually larger in terms of its as a source of federal government financing than the so-called progressive income tax, which is no longer very progressive at all, and of course it gives special benefits to unearned income, notably capital gains.
And that's really part of the modern trick to this new world order, is that capital gains was the main game for those in the know, and the rest of us are stuck earning wages and thinking through harder work we can get ahead. Now, we're sort of critiquing economics here and how the supposed incentives through the tax system are directing how we behave, and it's become quite destructive economics in its handling of human endeavour. Recently, Paul Krugman made the statement that how good it is for economies to invade small countries, how that adds to economic growth, and basically gave a positive argument for that. You were quite strong in critiquing this. Would you like to outline the story and your critique of it?
It was just an aside, actually, in an article by Krugman reviewing another major book about the crash called What It Can't Happen. This Time Is Different is the name of the book. And what happened was he was saying, well, you know, what evidence do we have that Keynesian stimulus spending really works to rev up the economy? And, I mean, to my absolute astonishment, he comes up with this example that under Mussolini, who in 1935-1936 invaded Abyssinia, part of Ethiopia, that helped stimulate the Italian economy. And an argument like that is so weak. First of all, it's, you know, post hoc ergo propter hoc. That is saying because it happened, therefore it was the cause. But, you know, Mussolini was a dictator. Mussolini was also doing a lot of things, reorganizing the Italian economy. Supposedly he made the trains run on time. But he was also creating his own economic statistics. And I was thinking, my God, if that's the best argument or the best example Krugman can come up with for a successful economic stimulus, we're really in trouble. And I think the Keynesian argument that any old sort of spending is good for the economy to get it out of a recession is just a very poor argument. It is important to keep the social services up. It is important to try to keep money available to small business, because they're the people who create the jobs. But the idea that something as totally wasteful as military spending can be good for the economy is just—it just shows how bankrupt this pop Keynesian understanding of economics.
Do you think in the future environmental spending, such as repairing ecosystem services and the like, will be a useful form of Keynesian pump priming? And do you think with the rates of skin cancer in
3CR, handmade radio.